This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The Murder of Mary Fagan, Part 7. I'll pick up where I left off the last time, reading from an article titled 99 Years Ago, Did Leo Frank Confess? By Mark Cohen. Two of the last points that I had mentioned were that Frank had made during the trial a 3 to 4, between 3 and 4 hour long unsworn statement. And the bulk of that statement was him going through in excruciating detail his accounting work that he supposedly was so busy doing on that Saturday that the murder occurred. That was his way of trying to convey to the courtroom and to the jury that he was just too busy and had too much to do, and he couldn't have possibly murdered Mary Fagan. That was his defense. That's how he chose to defend himself. The other point that was mentioned is the bathroom confession. And the whole reason I got into this article was because, well, it's a good article as far as a summary of the, in a nutshell, why Leo Frank is guilty. It's called Confessions. I've expressed my own distaste for that, calling it that rhetoric, but I did want to list what they were. I was curious, where is a good list of what these supposed confessions were? And this article seems to be the source of the list and the rhetoric of confession. So I had already talked about one, which had to do with the fact that Frank, after denying at first that he had ever left his desk during the day, admitted during this 3 to 4 hour testimony that he gave, that he might have gone to the bathroom. And the reason he finally admitted that was because of the testimony of Montine Stover, who was actually called as a supporting character witness in his favor by the defense. Now, Montine Stover was the other girl that showed up on that Saturday looking for her pay and couldn't find Leo Frank. He wasn't at his desk, and she waited apparently for 5 minutes at his office. And another excuse that Leo Frank gave, besides that, well, maybe I was in the bathroom, was that he was behind a safe and that maybe she didn't see him. But, if she was there for 5 minutes, and Cohen makes this point, that she probably would have looked behind the safe during that time and seen him or heard him scribbling at his desk at least. Anyway, on to the list of confessions. Confession number one that he lists in his article has to do with the statements, the testimony that Jim Conley, the black sweeper that worked at the factory, gave. And I'll have a lot more to say about Jim Conley probably in the next installment, but we'll go into some of the details about Jim Conley's testimony. But he was supposedly the source of one of these confessions, or the recounted one of Leo Frank's confessions, because Leo Frank, he claimed, told him that he had tried to, quote, be with her, unquote. And Mark Cohen helpfully explains that means have sexual intercourse with Mary Fagan, but she refused him. And confession number two, according to Cohen, refers to the McKnight, Manola McKnight, the housemaid for the Franks, claimed she overheard and told her husband that she overheard this conversation. And they both gave depositions that claim that recounted this hearsay, it's called in legal terms, about what somebody else, what they heard somebody else say, and that they heard Frank confess to his wife in private that he had killed Mary Fagan. He didn't know why he would murder, he said, supposedly, and that's when he also asked for that pistol to shoot himself. Confession number three has to do with this, quote, unconscious bathroom visit, unquote. So there was a fourth confession that was referred to in the other document that I had been reading from earlier, the longer, more rambling article. And I really don't know what that fourth confession is, but if I run into it, I'll mention it in a later installment. So who is Mark Cohen? That's one of the things that I was curious about. Last time I said that, you know, just from the name, I was skeptical as to whether this would be even worth reading, this article. It was worth reading. And I found out a little bit about Mark Cohen. There's an article on leofrank.org about a complaint by the Anti-Defamation League about this Mark Cohen that points then, it doesn't actually link it, but it points to the National Vanguard site that I got this list of confessions article on. And it's actually in a separate article that lists at the top of the article that, let's see what it is, Leo Frank, who really solved the Mary Fagan murder case? Another article of Cohen's, Mark Cohen's at National Vanguard. And it says right at the top of that article that, quote, Mark Cohen, unquote, is the nom de guerre of a man who has devoted his life and fortune to exposing a century-long conspiracy of those who knowingly omitted testimony and fabricated evidence to cover up the Leo Frank case. And so it pretty much admits there that Mark Cohen is just a pseudonym for some other person. I presume that they're not a Jew because they're far too honest. And what they have to write about Leo Frank is far too condemning. Now, I have another article to talk about to contrast with Mark Cohen's work, which also talks about Mark Cohen. That's why I ran into it. But just during the segue here between the two, I want to mention and call attention to this separate but equal principle that was the prevailing constitutional law interpretation of the Constitution at the time in the United States. The Wikipedia article describes it as the legal doctrine in the United States constitutional law that justified and permitted racial segregation. And under the doctrine, services, facilities, public accommodations, housing, medical care, education, employment, and transportation were allowed to be separated along racial lines, provided that the quality of each group's public facilities was equal. So separate but equal. It was first decided that it was valid to, this principle was valid in Plessy versus Ferguson, a court decision that was handed down in 1896. And it was eventually ultimately overturned, starting with the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954. But during the time of the Leo Frank trial, and it was the prevailing wisdom for society at the time, was that the races should be segregated. And the interesting thing about that is Jews were considered white under that. The Jews were not segregated from whites. They were not considered a separate race. And that's not a good thing for whites. But we'll get into that. So this other article that I ran into is titled Why I Write, Three Strangling Deaths, The Murder of Mary Fagan and the Lynching of Leo Frank. And it's written by someone whose name is Scott Aron, A-A-R-O-N. And he has a site that of his own that's leofrank.info. And this is just one of several articles that he posted there. It doesn't seem to be active anymore. The last article was on April, posted in April of 2013. And it seems to have something to do with some book that, that he was contemplating writing. I couldn't find any link to a title of the book, so I assume he never published it, or maybe I'm just not any good at looking, but never did find it. But this article was interesting for a couple of reasons. Now, he mentioned strangling, three strangling deaths. He's referring to strangling of Fagan to begin with, and then the lynching of Frank at the end of that trial. And finally, he says that the third strangling is the truth, because he's got a different attitude than most Jews, as he tries to explain. He tries to strike an equivocal pose about the Frank saga, and it seems to me that he's pretending that there's some sort of equivalence between whites and Jews, and that's the basic sense that I get from this article, and that it doesn't really exist. But let me read a little bit of what he has to say, and you can see for yourself. He starts off by summarizing the case as he sees it. The case aroused the outrage and ire and vengeance of two great communities. See, that's the sort of separate but equal equivalence that he draws. One, the Jewish community, feel overwhelmingly today and felt to a lesser degree but still substantial extent in 1913 that Leo Frank was tried and condemned simply because he was a Jew. They believe that Leo Frank is so obviously innocent that he never would have been tried, had it not been for endemic anti-Semitism in 1913 Atlanta. And they have been remarkably effective in making Southern anti-Semitism the leitmotif of virtually all drama, documentary, and other remembrance of this case for the last half century. The other community, that is, the largely Christian Southern Gentile community, believed overwhelmingly in 1913, and to an unknown but doubtless large degree still believe today, that justice was done when all the jurors and every appeal court in the land, including the Supreme Court of the United States, after a monumental and impressively funded defense, agreed that Leo Frank was fairly tried and convicted for the murder of Mary Fagan. And it must rankle Southerners almost beyond words to be accused of antisemitism when no Christian community anywhere on earth has so respected and welcomed Jews, has so openly acknowledged its spiritual roots in Judaism, or has so enthusiastically supported the Jewish state of Israel. See, there is no real equivalence there. On the one side, he describes the Southerners, who basically did things by the book and to a fault respected and welcomed Jews. And on the other side, he describes the Jews who thought themselves better and above the law and who have tried the whole time to overturn the justice being done in this case. Now, why he writes is what this article is about. Why does Scott Aaron write? And a little bit about Mark Cohen here, too. Will this rediscovery of the truth cause a backlash of real antisemitism against Southern Jews or Jews in general? I think not. Just because a few soi-disant, that means self-styled or so-called, leaders, cranks, and self-promoters palmed off their paranoid vision of the Frank case on a generation is no reason for a real vendetta. I intend to show that a middle path that respects truth above ethnic and religious loyalty is needed, and Jewish voices should be prominent in leading the way if we are to avoid another swing of the knife-edged pendulum of hate. One of the most remarkable things I discovered when writing this book, there he refers to his book, which I've never found, was that many of the original articles about this case, even major ones, and affidavits, sworn statements, and utterances of great import from the central participants in the case were not available online, not searchable, not findable, not even readable. That is, until a courageous man named Mark Cohen, almost 100 years after the fact, scanned in and uploaded nearly all the relevant contemporary newspapers, magazines, and surviving trial materials to his website, leofrank.org. I deeply appreciate Mr. Cohen's efforts in doing this service for us, for our posterity, and for history. I do not, however, endorse all of Mr. Cohen's theories or conclusions about the case. It was a monumental effort that must have taken years. And I would say that he makes a fair evaluation of Mark Cohen. Now, the funny thing about this is he seems to be under the impression, as I was initially, that Mark Cohen is a Jew. And that's why he's praising him. That's why he writes that paragraph about Mark Cohen and praises Mark Cohen right after saying that that's what he wants. That's why he's writing, is because he wants to present this middle view, this more moderate view. He's already, I thought, summarized accurately the Jewish attitude about the whole Leo Frank thing and their uncompromising and really one-sided version of it, which essentially blames the goyim for the problem, and the other side. And he's going to strike something in the middle. There is no middle ground to take, really. But he wants to pretend that there is. In fact, a middle path supposedly led by Jewish voices. Now, that's not a change from what we already have. What we have is Jewish voices and their Jewish media. They've got the megaphone. It's their narrative that really gets broadcast the loudest. On the internet, it's somewhat more equal because the search engines actually do return hits on leofrank.org and Mark Cohen and others that are skeptical and express their belief in Leo Frank's guilt get an equal say on the internet. But the Jews are working on that. Now, so Aaron basically comes across as being not so much concerned with justice for Mary Fagan and not even so much about whether Leo Frank was innocent or guilty. He's concerned about the Jews here and now today potentially being subjected to a backlash of real anti-Semitism, he says. And that's what he's trying to prevent, even though he discounts or downplays the possibility of it. That's what he seems to be motivated to write by. And in doing so, he tries to minimize the wrongdoing of the Jews, as I've already pointed out. He paints them as a few cranks and as the exception. He tries to limit the time frame to a single generation. And the truth is that what Aaron calls this paranoid vision is actually the rule for Jews. And he admits it implicitly with his call for a moderate middle path, that Jews should change themselves and take this more middle path. The truth is that the Jews on the whole have stood with Frank from the day he was arrested, and they have for every generation since, for the past 100 years. The slogan that they put on the plaque at the site at which he was lynched, wrongly accused, falsely convicted, wantonly murdered. That's the Jewish narrative about the Mary Fagan murder. It's actually Leo Frank who was the victim and Jews who were the victim. Even Jews who never knew Frank have all along acted as if he was some sort of direct extension of themselves. And they continue to come to his defense. They use the flimsiest arguments. They blame other people. And they argue that it was Frank who was the victim. And then, by extension, that Jews as a whole have been wronged by this whole thing. Aaron's call for Jewish voices to be prominent and leading the way is just a call for more of the same of what's been going on for the last 100 years. He just wants them to moderate their narrative a little bit to prevent a backlash. He thinks, I guess, that if the gap between their story and reality becomes too big, that might trigger the backlash. But he doesn't seem to understand, or he doesn't want to acknowledge to the non-Jews that he's probably aiming this rhetoric at, that inverting reality, including things as outrageous as blaming the goyim when it's Jews committing crimes, that's just what Jews do. That's what they always do. It's an essential part of who they are. It's an essential part of their narrative, of their self-image as victims. Helps enable their parasitism. It puts the host on the defensive, and it gives them the justification to take advantage of that host. So I'm just reading through a couple of notes here that I've already mentioned. So skipping ahead here a little bit to back to the American Mercury article that I've talked about previously, the 100 reasons Leo Frank is guilty. And I've, over the course of several installments now, selected out certain subsets of points from different places in that list and organized them according to topic. And in this case, there's three particular points, items number 91, 92, and 93, that address this issue of Southern anti-Semitism, supposed Southern anti-Semitism. And it makes some very good points that I'd like to get into here. Point 91 actually quotes Scott Aaron and says the writer Scott Aaron gives insight into Southern attitudes toward Jews when he says, quote, "In the race-conscious South of 1913, Jews were considered white. In fact, the newspapers of Atlanta before, during, and after the trial of Leo Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan, Frank was referred to as a, quote, white man, unquote, on innumerable occasions by reporters, witnesses, African-Americans, fellow Jews, pro-Frank partisans, and anti-Frank polemicists. Jews, furthermore, were not known for violent acts or crimes. not feared as violators of white women. That's not entirely true. I'll cite an article about an issue with that in a later installment. If anything, they were seen as an unusually industrious, intelligent, and law-abiding segment of society, even if they were a bit peculiar in their religious views. Yes, that is the usual mistaken impression that white people have of Jews throughout the centuries, throughout the millennia. It's the same thing, that the Jews, they kind of look like us. They are like us. They are us, except they just have a strange religion. And it's this cover of religion. In the previous year, did a whole series of podcasts on that I'd urge you to go listen to if you're not already familiar with this issue about what exactly are the Jews. Are they a religion, or are they a race, or what? To just put it simply, they're not a religion. And being a Jew really is independent of what religion they supposedly adhere to. But this is a very frequent and old canard that the Jews go to bamboozle white people into thinking that they are just a peculiar religion, but otherwise they're just like us. A little further down, it says, again, quoting from Aaron, "If there was prejudice against Leo Frank in 1913 Atlanta, it was almost certainly not because he was a Jew. He was, however, a capitalist, a business owner, a manager, an employer of child labor, and a northerner with an Ivy League education. He also came to be known during the course of the trial as sexually profligate. These facts probably did count against him." They most certainly did. He was actually considered a pervert, that his behavior towards the girls and women that worked for him was perverse, that they were outside of the norms of that society at the time. They would be considered outside the norms of society today, even. So that seems to be downplaying that aspect of it. And also, I've read this kind of attitude before, and in fact, I read it in an ADL description, some teaching aid that they have produced back in 2009, I think it was, having to do with the Leo Frank case. And this was their take on the Leo Frank saga, that Leo Frank was hated in part not only because he was a Jew, but that he was a capitalist, a northerner, I don't buy it, that it wasn't that at all. I think that too is an excuse. They're just looking for more excuses to blame the people who actually rightly arrested and convicted and tried and convicted and lynched Leo Frank. They didn't do anything wrong, but the Jews will come up with reasons forever and different ways in which they were wrong, because in their minds, Leo Frank could not have possibly been the murderer. Point 92 says that Aaron also cites a study that was actually funded and published by the American Jewish Committee, and I guess it was published in 1930. Talks about a range of dates from 1830 to 1930. It was a study that called the South historically the section least inclined to ostracize Jews, and drew attention to the, quote, striking Jewish Southern situation, unquote, of almost no discrimination against Jews there. So in other words, even the Jews themselves have admitted in the past that they experienced less anti-Semitism than in other places, relatively less, resistance. If you can trust the Jews. Point number 93 goes into the fact that Judah P. Benjamin during the Civil War was the Secretary of the Treasury and later Attorney General, Secretary of State, Secretary of War for the Confederate States of America. Big deal. You know, you're not supposed to condemn the Jews because of the actions of one Jew, although they all flock to the defense of even one Jew, like Leo Frank, whose guilt is fairly clear. But you're supposed to give all Jews a pass because of the behavior of one Jew, supposedly the good behavior of Judah Benjamin, which is not all that clear. However he behaved, it seems irrelevant. It's just another excuse. But at the end of point 93, they make a good point, which is worth reading here. If Leo Frank were innocent, why would his supporters have to fabricate such blatant impostures and engage in emotional blackmail on a colossal scale? And they're talking here about this charge that there was this rampant anti-Semitism, this rampant discrimination against Jews that Frank, at the time of the Frank trial, that Frank was only accused and tried because he was a Jew, that is the impostature and the emotional blackmail on a colossal scale that they're referring to here. And the reason why is because he wasn't innocent, and they can't think of any other excuse, really. That's the main excuse that they go to, is that it must have been that he was discriminated against. I have a few notes here about the asymmetry of anti-Semitism. Let's see if I can try and explain what I mean, what I'm thinking about this. You know, I've already kind of mentioned that this Jews blame anti-Semitism for the framing of Frank, for instance, that Frank was framed. Why? Because Dorsey and Hugh Dorsey, the prosecutor, and Scott, the Pinkerton investigator that Frank had hired, had changed his mind and decided that Frank was the one who was guilty, and that must have been because of Jew hate. And that somehow that flies, you know, because that's their part of their narrative. It's what they always use as the excuse for why people should ever accuse Jews of ever doing anything wrong. It's just because of some Jew hate that comes out of nowhere. There's no real explanation for it, because it definitely doesn't have to do with the Jews. It has something to do with some mental problem or moral failing in the people making the accusation. But the flip side of it is that Jews flocking to the defense of Leo Frank or any other Jewish criminal, any other Jew accused of wrongdoing, is perfectly understandable. It's tribalism, basically. It's ethnocentrism. It's perfectly natural. It's perfectly understandable. That's the reason for it, and that's why they do it. They see themselves on trial, and so they come to his defense. But it's really just the flip side, and it makes more sense than this supposed thing that seems to fly better, is the idea that Jew hate is what fuels people on the other side. And it's really about people responding to the harm that Jews are doing and complaining about it. And then the Jews call that anti-Semitism. Anyway, to wrap things up here, you know, the Southerners, they did indeed respect and welcome the Jews to their own detriment. They gave and the Jews took. The Jews aren't grateful for it. In the 100 years since, the Jews allied themselves with the blacks and they overthrew white dominance in the South and elsewhere in the United States. Today, the Jew-controlled mainstream media pours hatred on whites everywhere with impunity, but most especially on white Southerners. And most especially, they pour hatred on the poorest and most powerless of the white Southerners, people like Mary Fagan. Today, Atlanta is a black city. Whites have been leaving in droves for decades, and the Jews are flocking in. That's where respecting and welcoming the Jews get you.